This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Confringe reading series. Alrighty, folks, it's time for the final lap of the evening, where we get to ask our readers some interesting and entertaining questions. I'll start with Sophie. Towards the end of your reading, you reveal that the characters have to go off to the Himalayas, and there's talk of a hidden land called Shambhala, and my ears pricked up at that, having read too many books on Eastern mysticism when I was much, much younger. Would you like to tell us a little bit about Shambhala?
Yeah, no, that's fine. What it was is when I was a kid, I read, it's Hilton's Lost Paradise, about Shangri-La, and I always wanted the place to be real. And when I started doing research for this, which took far longer than it should have, but it was greatly enjoyable, I was sort of reading all about Hindus and especially Tibetan myths and legends and how they really do believe that there is a land, Shambhala, within the Himalayas that hasn't been found by humanity yet. And this sort of legend goes back hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of years. And I was... because I like all my places, even though they're fantastical, they're all rooted in real places. So for me, Kalon, which is a massive underground city about the size of London, very, very bustling, very alive, that's underneath the Congolese jungles, and it all makes sense when you read it. But but for me, Shambhala was the perfect place to have my sort of sacred kingdom of dragons. And so I was reading all about all the myths and legends to do with that. How they think there's snow leopards which have got imbued with spirits of the dead, and yeah, you got it, and all of this, and it all sort of seeps its way in. Even if you only use a tiny little snippet of the research you do, I think it gives you a real sort of flavour, a sort of a background which you can sort of, I don't know, it just makes it more real for the reader, I think. So yeah, love all that stuff.
Yeah, you can't go wrong putting a few snow leopards into a story. Yeah, so the other thing that struck me while I was listening to you is you had somebody answering riddles in a cave in the dark. And I think I remember another fantasy book with that in. So are you a fan?
Yes.
Yeah, no, it's weird, actually.
It's only after I wrote that. It sounds bizarre. It hadn't twigged. Because I'd read The Hobbit so many years ago, and of course this was before the films came out, I'd written the passage and then moved on and gone on to other things. And it was only rereading it, I thought, oh, shit. Oh, this is a bit familiar. Bloody hell. So it's, I thought, well, no, I'll keep it in, because it was fresh when I wrote it. But, yes, there was a few little similarities which crept in without me knowing.
Well, I think probably The Hobbit has sort of wormed its way into our collective subconscious now, and putting bits of Tolkien in there is like putting elves or fairies or whatever into a book. It's just there. One final question, because you did give me an opening for a shameless plug. You mentioned that last year you'd gone to your first ever science fiction convention, and it was quite fun. So which convention was this?
It was Bristol Con. I can actually say it was the best time ever, and I well, it was, well, I know, but I mean, I've been to all sorts of book events. In fact, I'm off to Hay on Sunday to see Katsuo Ishiguro. Yes. Brilliant author. So I go to all sorts of book things, but I don't even know why, because I'm such a nerd. I should have been going to every convention since the age of zero. But anyway, so it was the first one I'd ever been to, and what a one to go to. I met a bloke, Jim Burns, who I'm just in love with his artwork, and it's like, ha, 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 ha. I went to the most amazing talks, came across really cool people, someone called Joanne Hall, bumped into my mate Will, who was there selling his books, so obviously my publisher and everything, and it was just a really cool place. Jasper Ford, drooled over him for a bit, met Mark Lawrence. It was just an amazingly cool, relaxed place to be, and it makes me as a nerd feel really like, yeah, I'm at home here.
Yeah, Jasper's one of our guests of honour next year, so if you could manage to avoid not drooling on him, because then we'd have to pay for getting him cleaned up.
You might like it.
Yeah, yes. Ben says he might like it, and that's a good point. We'd better ask him first. Now, moving on to Ben now. Westerns seem to be suddenly a thing that, you know, there were no Westerns for about a decade or so, and then all of a sudden we've seen a whole bunch cropping up, in particular, of course, Stark Holborn with Nunslinger, who we had here a few months ago. So what was it inspired you to start doing a Western?
That's a very easy question. 310 to Yuma. The remake as well, not the original. No, I mean, I just got into the genre, mainly the film genre, ages ago, a couple of years ago, sorry, and I just started thinking, this is very similar to medieval fantasy in weird ways. You know, it's a time of discovery, it's a time of darkness, few rules, and you can draw strange comparisons between, you know, shamans, wizards, you know, the lone gunslinger, the lone mercenary knight, and it just all seemed to fit together. So I just had this idea doing a Western one day, and then for some reason I was working on a magic system, or the idea of a magic system, and hence the name Blood Rush, which is my sort of form of magic in the book, which is all about drinking different types of blood, i.e. shades, and using the animal's power as a magical power. So it sort of comes from the Scythian myths and a range of other, and also Native American myths as well. So I suddenly thought, hang on, this is quite, you know, I was going to write this for another book and then use, oh well, it comes from the Native Americans, which probably wouldn't exist in the world I was creating, I'll do a Western. And it's sort of just as simple as that, and I just always wanted to do it. Yeah, I think coming from frost and snow and mountains from my last series, the Emanesca series, it was fun to do somewhere warm as well, and lots of desert. But yeah, mutual love and coincidence.
Well, given the weather we've had today, I think we'd all like to move to the American desert. But, okay, so you said something rather interesting there, that Native Americans might not have existed in the world that you're creating. I mean, obviously, you know, there's stuff to be revealed through the book. Can you tell us a little bit more about the America that is in this alternate world of yours?
So basically, it's... yeah, I mean, it's an alternate 1867, so it draws on a huge amount of the actual historical happenings in 1867. So we had Benjamin Disraeli sort of organising it, well, not organising, but wading into the war against the Ottoman Empire. We had, obviously, the Transcontinental Railroad spreading across America, sort of uniting in Utah eventually. So my world is completely, well, not completely different, but it's different in the way that America's West Coast has not been discovered. So they can't get across the wastes due to multiple things, storms, mainly the Native American sort of creatures that I have. So there are no traditional Native Americans in my world. They're called the Shohari, and they're sort of more... one of my readers compared them sort of to the Na'vi out of Avatar, sort of thing. So if you can sort of imagine that. But yeah, and we don't have a Queen Victoria, we have a Queen Victorious who's not quite human, and no one's actually seen her face ever, or at least in the last 500 years. So there's sort of these, I guess, sort of weird fiction, dark fantasy elements weaved into it. But yeah, so then the railroad that they're building is not the Transcontinental Railroad to sort of unite East and West Coast. It's actually the weapon that they're using to defeat the wilderness. So yeah, Wyoming is literally the frontier. Yeah.
That kind of reminds me of China Mieville's Iron Council, with just building the line out there and civilization sort of following the line where you go.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, he's it's a great book, and also Rail Sea as well. Love that. But I took a lot of influences from Dark Tower, obviously great. You know, arguably one of the first sort of major Western fantasy crossovers. One Night in Sixes as well is another great example. If anyone hasn't tried that, really good. But yeah, cool.
And for the benefit of my boyfriend, hello Kevin. Are there a lot of train things in this book?
Yeah, I've sort of gone a little bit steampunk at the same time as going alternate history. So yes, there are airships. Most of the weapons are either clockwork or ridiculously massive, like 19-barreled guns. it's got a few steampunk elements as well as being, yeah, weird West, Western fantasy. And yeah, a lot of locomotives, a lot of steam trains. There's even, of course, the classic train robbery, but with a little twist as well. So, yeah.
Alrighty, so if you're listening, Kevin, I'll get hold of the book for you. does anybody have any questions for either Sophie or for Ben? What a surprise. Hello, Justin.
Ben, hi. Yeah, I'm Justin. Hi. I was intrigued by the prologue and some other elements of your story. Because the prologue, I guess, you know, you start wide, you start broad, you know, you really want to draw the reader into to a mystery world, you know. And I thought you did that really well. You kind of draw the reader in to you know, a different time, different place. I just wonder where you got that prologue from, and did you write it at the beginning, or did you write it having written it all?
Yeah, that was actually chapter four. That's the start of chapter four. And I had one of my beta readers, one of my friends, Andy, who's a massive reader, and he basically said that should be at the start. Yeah. Take it out and put it at the start as a prelude or prologue. And it was because chapter four is where I introduced the rest of the Fae. And so it goes, so basically they've got a city inside a well in the middle of Jekyll Park, which is Hyde Park. yeah. Shameless. I couldn't resist. Yeah, it was called Londinium for about... up until the end of the novel, and I thought, I can't do that to myself. I'm going to change it. So, yeah, there's a few things that are very, very close. But anyway, so I was writing about them. I got so wrapped up in just describing their world, and there's the 13 sort of main Fae characters who end up chasing Rin and Merion over the Atlantic Ocean, or the Iron Ocean. And so, yeah, when I was writing that, and so I was trying to introduce this subculture that's literally just below our feet, that has withdrawn over the last centuries and hidden us and despise us. And so I was writing that as an explanation for why they're still around, and then, yeah, it just ended up being the prologue. Because it sort of described not just the Fae, but the Shahari and the magic in general that event ends up becoming sort of prevalent to the storyline.
Next question.
Okay, Ben, this is probably one that you get asked a lot, but I'm going to ask you anyway. What was behind your decision to self-publish rather than go with a traditional publisher, and have you got any tips for people who would be aspiring to self-publish?
That's a good question. I do get asked a lot, and the answer changes. But no, I mean, initially, to cut a long story short, I went to a music uni. So I went and studied contemporary music in Guildford, and it was all about teaching you know, people to be independent artists. And obviously, the music industry was going through the same sort of changes as the book industry was, but 5-6 years ahead, the MP3, the ebook, iBooks, iTunes, also, you know, very, very similar. So I found that I'd missed the boat. And as much as I love music and still do, I sort of fell out of love with it and fell back in love with writing. So I then started to Google agents once I'd finished my first book, The Written, went through it, and then thought, everything I'm reading, you know, taking this, taking that, the control gets taken away, you know, from, well, I had all these horror stories as well. Obviously, in amongst the great stories, you know, publishers are great companies, they do great things. But I think, you know, the time scale, I was very, very passionate about getting out of this bar job that I was working in, and, you know, working a string of just boring, endless, menial jobs. And I wanted my books to be the way out of it. So I thought, I need this now. I can't wait, you know, 18 months plus to sort of be accepted by an agent and a publisher. I'm going to sort of use all the skills I've learned in the music industry and turn them into self-publishing. Obviously, I wasn't the first one to do it. Self-publishing revolution had sort of kicked off by then, so I jumped on the bandwagon and learned how to do it. So yeah, I was kind of lucky in that respect, having some of the skills needed. But I'd say the tip for any authors wanting to publish is just aim high. You know, the main thing with self-publishing is that a lot of people don't spend the time or money on good covers and good editing. And so to, you know, get to where most people want to be, you need to be at a level, if not better if you can, of, you know, the top publishers and the top bestsellers out there, you know, in your writing, but as well as how you produce your book.
I think that's such great advice, because, I mean, I'm with a small publisher now, Grimbold Books, which are brilliant, but actually I can speak from personal experience. My first publishers were horrendous. And, I mean, God, given the choice between the sort of, well, what was produced under them, I defy anyone to say that that was a good quality. It just was not. So, I mean, I agree with you totally. I don't think it matters if you're published or self-published. If quality is the end game that you're going for, then actually that's all that matters. So my advice to anyone out there would be, you know, if you're going for quality, then why wait for a publisher? You know, if you want a publisher, fine. But for God's sake, get some advice. Get your contract looked at and don't jump too quickly. I'm lucky now. I found my feet now. But boy, I wish I hadn't gone through that first experience. So, yeah.
Yeah, and Ben, of course, said a very important word there, editing. please, please do not just write your book and then publish it. You know, get someone to look at it first. By the way, the mention of independent musicians reminds me that Amanda Palmer is playing a gig at St. George's on the 29th. I believe there are tickets still available if anybody wants to go. I know I will be there. Any other questions for either of our readers? Richard?
This is a question to both of you, because it will kind of split nicely between them. How do you both go about doing your advertising and marketing, so comparing the traditional publishing with the self-publishing and the amount of work involved and the style that you both choose to do?
I think, first of all, you've got to be a persistent bugger. Don't take no for an answer. Keep going, even when you're knackered, even when it's 12 o'clock at night and you really should be thinking about going to sleep. Just keep plugging at it. I mean, obviously, whether it's self-published or a small publishing house, there is not going to be a massive budget for promotion the way that would be in the big five. That's just not going to happen. And again, I think I don't think it matters if you're self-published or with a publisher, if the quality of the promotion is good as well. I mean, I've got quite a few friends which are on both sides of the fence, and to be honest with you, what you don't want to do is that thing of buy my book, because it's cheaper. You could have the best book in the world, but it cheapens you as an author. It cheapens the work that you've done. So, and it really gets people's backs up. So don't spam ever. And I think actually the biggest thing I could say is get contacts, real life contacts, not just Facebook, but you know, go to events like this, like Bristol Con, any sort of literary festivals that are around, even if they're small, and you know. Get your groundwork in, get your name known, put your cards out there, always have a book on hand. And it's just, I think it is about making a network of people and growing it slowly. You won't be an overnight success. I don't care if you've written the best novel in the world. It's just very unlikely that you're going to be an overnight hit. But you can build some steady groundwork and just be respectful of people. You know, you're not the only author out there. There's a hell of a lot of people that have written books. In fact, everyone I know, virtually, yeah. So just be respectful. Don't shove it down their face. And also, if I'm a great one for favours, you know, do somebody a favour, but don't expect it to be right. Oh, I'll do this for you if you do that for me. Just be genuine. Because again, if the last thing you can do if you're spamming people is, that's the way to nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, I market in a huge amount of ways. I do a lot of events. I am a social media addict. I've probably done about 50 tweets today. I think my marketing is quite incessant. But yeah, as you know, we were saying, it needs to be. I always think of it like a dinner party, especially on social media. So, you know, I wouldn't wander into a circle in a dinner party and start shouting at the top of my lungs why my book's got 5 stars on Amazon. You know, I'd sort of walk in, wait for my chance to speak, introduce myself, you know, and be human, which I think a lot of people forget. So I try and do that, and just use social media and email and websites to just be, a normal person who happens to write books, and if people like it, that's great. And that's sort of the foundation of it. And then I do things on top, you know, paid promotions, of course. Every indie author does that. And anything that I can do. So, yeah. But I think in terms of how you split it between the writing and the marketing, I will always be a writer first. I think you have to be. You know, there are authors, I work with, I help a lot of authors self-publish as a consultant. And I always get them saying, well, I've been marketing for 6 days solid. And it's like, well, what about your next book? That's the most powerful marketing tool there is. And it's also a product on the shelf. So, I mean, I always write and get my word count done for the day before I do any marketing. I might do a tweet here and there. 10. Bacon, yes. Bacon, rats, and that's it. And books.
There's something about authors and bacon, isn't there? Alrighty. Any other questions for our readers? Peter?
I'm going to ask about the other end of the business then. Now that we've talked about marketing, what about distribution for small press and for self-publishing? Getting into those bricks and mortar shops.
Oh, so it's the man with a book ahead.
that is a tricky one. But I mean, you have to start with making it available to brick and mortar stores, first of all. So I mean, if you're self-publishing, there's several incredible solutions that you can use for like print on demand that actually feed into the distribution network, in the global distribution network, you know, Ingram's, Gardner's, Bertrand's, and anything in between as well. So yeah, if you use one of those, then you'll be available. Having an ISBN obviously is paramount, well, imperative. barcodes as well, having a good price, making sure that your wholesale discount is large enough to give the retailer a, you know, a cut, and the distributor as well, so they're not just making 5p off your book, which is not worth their time. So yeah, doing those. And then again, I mean, I got lucky in the fact that I had Guildford Waterstones literally pretty much next door to where I was living. So I knew a couple of the people that worked there, and I'd gone to uni with them. And so I got in, I went in there one day with a couple of books and just, you know, said, here's a present to your staff. You know, just if you, you know, the guys that know me, have a read, this is my new book. And they, one of them called me up in a couple of weeks later and said, we'd love to stock it. We noticed it's actually available via Gardeners. And so, yeah, they were kind enough to do that. And so from there, I just made sure they sold using marketing and bribing people. And fake disguises, mustaches, yeah, those sorts of things going in. I'd like to buy this book. And then from there, you know, that success just spiraled outwards. And then so I've been lucky enough to do a couple of tours with Waterstones around the UK, you know, self-organized, just literally phoning up and being like, I've done well in this store near you guys. You know, this is the margin you get. This is where it's available from. What do you reckon? And so, yeah, they've, you know, usually most of the time said yes, which is great. So now I've got those connections. But Waterstones has shut down slightly on events anyway, mainly because someone in Bluewater chased someone around. No, that was it. They were sliding business cards in between all the books of their competitors. I think there are only real competitors in book writing, really. But yeah, they're just sliding their business cards in the shelves and then chasing people around with their books and doing very hardcore sales tactics. So that's all. Yeah. But yeah, that's what I recommend. Yeah.
Pretty much the same. I did a couple of Waterstone book tours a couple of years ago, and they were greatly, hugely successful, and that was fabulous. And Waterstones, even though they're a big chain, it will differ completely depending on what shop you're in. So when I was doing Cardiff Waterstones, I was in a prime position. It's fabulous. When I did the one at Cribbs Causeway, I call it the Sea of Asses. They'd moved where they had the tills, and they didn't have enough staff on that day. So the queue from the tills came all the way out to my little table, and all I could see was a sea of asses. So it was a bit difficult. I mean, I did all right in the end, but it's like, oh, right, okay. You've got to take your ego out. Yeah, I almost thought about it. But I have noticed a massive difference. That was in 2012. 2012 and going into 2013. Now it is. I mean, I don't know. You're very lucky if you're getting into Waterstones. Now I found it impossible. The same stores where I sold a bucket load of books 2-3 years ago have said, I'm really sorry, look, we love your book, we love your illustrations, da 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 da. We know you're professional, you sit your ass down, which is what you should be doing, instead of costing customers. So they say all that, they say, I'm sorry, the policy's changed. It's really, I think James Daunt has got a lot to do with it. The policy has totally changed because a few bad apples ruined it for everyone, and they are saying no, no, no. And it's really frustrating, because even when you've got a proven sales record, and you say, look, come on, we sold out of books in Swindon, you know, it doesn't matter. So I have found that really frustrating, not being able to get back into Waterstones the way I did a few years ago. What I would say is love your local independent. Say hello to them as often as you can. If you give your local independents love, it will reciprocate. In fact, I just did a book signing on Sunday at Octavia's Bookshop in Cirencester, which won the Booksell Awards. It's very prestigious, all the rest of it. And she loves indie authors. So, you know, if you... Even if Waterstones really have got their door shut forever and anon, and there's a bit of there might be some movement possibly in the future on that, you can still get it into bricks and mortar shops in your independents. Just, you know, be respectful, and for God's sake, when you're doing a signing, sit your ass down. That's the biggest thing I can say. I unfortunately know of at least one person who is, I wonder if it's the same one, who I would never out her because she's had a terrible couple of years, but she used to literally frog march customers to the tills. And in one of the Waterstones she signed in, she went up at the end of the signing and said, right, I've sold 30 books. And they said, no, you haven't. And every single customer she thrust a book at had then placed it down and not sold it at the till. And, of course, that was it. The Waterstones shut their doors to her and she never got any more signs. But the problem is that then had a knock-on effect for all other indie authors. We were all sort of brushed with the same tar, I'm afraid. So it is tough out there. So I would just say use any outlet you can. Literary festivals are springing up left, right and centre. Hawkesbury Upton one is one I did a few weeks ago, which is the first ever Cirencester I'm doing this year, which is only the third, fourth year doing it. Just keep phoning people, keep inquiring, and hopefully some of them will open their doors. But it's a bit hit and miss.
Just add to that that when Airship Shape and Bristol Fashion came out, I got on extremely well with the manager in my local Waterstones in Trowbridge, and I had exactly the same story from her. There's one or two people who'd been on signings and behaved really, really badly, and consequently they weren't allowed to do author signings anymore. We couldn't even get Airship Shape and Bristol Fashion into Bristol Waterstones. They would not take it. So, but on the other hand, you have to be friendly to your local science fiction bookshop, don't you, Des?
Oh, yes.
Okay. I think Gareth wants to add to that.
I just wanted to say that Waterstones Liverpool 1 do have a very, very active genre scene. I did a signing up there in January, and they seem to have every month one or two authors in to talk and sign books, so they're very much worth investigating.
Thank you.
Yeah, they have some really good staff at Waterstones in Liverpool, so yeah, definitely worth a try. But it is a national policy, so if they can't take you, it's not their fault.
Yeah, I know that independent in Siren, it's a wonderful little bookshop, but it's really for a lot of young adult stuff there as well.
They have got an adult section at the back. I mean, yes, most of it is dedicated to kids. Certainly, my book is not a kid's book. I mean, I've had 10-year-olds read it, but it's got a lot of battle violence and stuff in there, which is not suitable for young children at all. But it's, no, I mean, even an independent shop like that, where it is very much child-centred, they will still, virtually all of them, including Octavius, will have an adult section. So it's worth inquiring. You might not get the kiddies coming along for your book, but you'll get others. And she's very, very good at getting publicity out. So again, I'd say any shop you're signing in, for instance, that one, you've got magazines like Cirencester, Scene Magazine, you know, whichever place the bookshops in, get in touch with the local magazines as well. The Cirencester Festival is, God, I should know this, I think it's from the 27th of July to the 3rd of August, and I'm doing the 29th of July, a special illustrators edition. I'll be doing an illustrators talk in front of a bunch of kids and having great fun, basically. But it's another opportunity to sell the book as well. But it's really worth, and Hawkesbury Upton was the first time this year. It's a tiny little village that they did a, yeah, it's off to the sort of east of Yate, but they had Katie Ford opening it. So it is, and also the lady that runs it, Debbie Young, she's an aficionado of self-publishing too. And she, again, like Ben, she's a brilliant tactician at promotions, publicity. I mean, she used to work for Readathon. In fact, they interviewed me a couple of years ago. She's left it now, but she's got amazing contacts. And she actually has started that literary festival herself, basically. But it's had such a great review already, just this first one. It's going to snowball. So I'd say get in touch with anyone like that locally. If Waterstones won't have you, just keep going with everyone else until they do.
I feel like I ought to put in a plug for the Bristol Festival of Literature here, except we've already arranged an event and we've booked a couple of charlatans called Joanne Hall and Jonathan L. Howard. I don't know whether they've actually written any books or anything, but they talk good, you know. Has anybody else got any questions for our readers? No, it looks like we are finally running dry. So, Jo, do we have any announcements?
Yeah, we've got several. Next week's pub meeting in here is on Tuesday, because Monday is a bank holiday. So if you can't usually come on Mondays, then you can come on Tuesday next week. And if you turn up on Monday, we won't be here. That has happened before, that we've changed the date and people have turned up and gone, where is everybody? So Tuesday next week. A couple of other things. Next month's Fringe is going to be a special flash fiction workshop. We're starting earlier. We're starting at 7. We're running a workshop until 8. And then people who have done the workshop will be reading out their stuff for the next hour or so. That's going to be hosted by Kevlyn Henney, who is a flash man. he's a flash guru. He flashes for Britain. He's won prizes for flashing. He is a super flasher. I'm going to keep talking now before I get myself in trouble. The other thing I was thinking of was that Gareth's brother Hugh is going to be signing the second volume in his Space Jacker series in Waterstones and Cribs on the 4th of July. If anybody would like to go to that, it will be fab. I can't think of any more. Has Pete got any? Have you got any? Are you? Yeah, Pete's got some. Pete's always got one.
Bristol HorrorCon, which is on the 17th of October, are running a competition at the moment to write scary stories. I think it's a 4,000-word limit and closes on the 5th of September, so details are on the HorrorCon website.
Alrighty, I have a few as well. This Wednesday at Foyles, Lucien Boyce, who's a local history writer, will be launching her latest novel, which I believe is an independent publication. It's all going to be about the Bristol boxing scene in the 18th or 19th century, something like that. So it sounds really interesting. So if anybody's free on Wednesday evening, do pop along to Foyles. I will be there. Then on Wednesday the 27th, Cory Doctorow is appearing at the Festival of Ideas. It's at 12:30 in the middle of the day, so I guess some of you might be at work and not able to make it, but Cory is a fascinating chap. I think he's promoting the Information Doesn't Want to Be Free book. Anybody wanting to come along, I shall doubtless see you there. I've told you all about the Amanda Palmer gig, but I will tell you about it again because it's going to be wonderful. And finally, my next book slot on Ujima Radio is going to be on Wednesday, June the 3rd, when I will have Kevlyn Henney, he of the flashing. And I'm sorry. Yes. Kevlyn will flash on the radio and he will... presumably flash on podcast if somebody records this, which reminds me, I'm not going to be here to record that one because I will be on my way to Finland to see the George Martin chap. But the 3rd of June on Ujima Radio, Kevlyn Henney and Lucien Boyce. And Joe has remembered something else.
Not so much that I've remembered, but Sophie and Ben are both very, very far too polite to tell you that they've both got books for sale if you want to buy them.
Indeed they have. Anybody else got any announcements? Nope. In which case, those of you who can, don't forget to vote in the Hugos. I won't mention podcasts again, but something called Tea and Jeopardy might be up for an award. And finally, I have to thank our two readers, Sophie Tallis and Ben Galley, for providing such wonderful entertainment. Thank you, as usual, to the Shakespeare Tavern. And thank you to Lyra for not biting the microphone cable, despite the fact that we dangled it in front of her face a remarkably large number of times. BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.